Lior Zahavi, a lifelong modeler from Israel, has garnered a dedicated following owing to his pilot skills, his technical knowledge and experience, and a genuine passion for assisting others in the RC community. Renowned within the turbine jet scene, Lior not only pilots these advanced machines, but also pioneers the development of sensors and software for FreeSky and Futaba under the Zavionics brand. In this conversation, we cover many different topics. Lior talks about his start in the hobby, how he got started with jets, his switch from Futaba to FreeSky, common mistakes people make when setting up jets, plus a deep dive on fuel systems.
Hey Lior, how's it going?
I'm good, how are you?
Good, thanks for coming to Skype on RC Podcast. Nice to have you here.
You're welcome, my pleasure. It's good to be here.
Maybe you can start, for those people that might not be familiar with you, could you give a bit of a background about yourself, about how you got started in the hobby?
Oh yeah, certainly. So my name is Lior, I'm from Israel. I just turned 40 and I've been flying for about 30 years, so in RC, so pretty much since age 10 or so. So it's a funny story. I'm actually the only one from my family that got into the hobby as a child. My father used to take us, and that's me, my brother and my sister, to watch people flying RC planes close to where we lived at the time here in Israel. And I remember as a very small child that I was like, yeah, you know, I want one of these. And my dad always said like, yeah, okay, you need to grow up a little bit, then you can build your own, because back then, I'm talking something around maybe 1990 or so, you couldn't really get, you know, something like ready to fly ARF format or whatever. You had to build everything from either scratch or kits. So I started building at the age of 10. And back then, again, it was very difficult because you had to work for around a year to build a small Balsa remote control plane. crashed my first one in the second flight with an instructor, but I didn't give up. I tried again and again and again because, well, I can't even tell you why. It's in my blood, I think. So I just liked it and pretty much grew myself into this. So started flying helicopters when I was around 16 years old, I think. Flew helis with 3D and all that stuff back in the day, which was pretty new at the time, for around, if I remember correctly, 12 or 13 years. And basically, from the moment I laid my first hand on a jet, it was done, you know. I pretty much stopped flying the helicopters, started flying jets. That was around 15 years ago. And ever since, I've been focusing on jets, but I really like to fly. I always tell people I like to fly anything. You know, if somebody hands me over a 46 size trainer, I'll have a good time flying it. So I like to fly everything basically. But really, my main focus is on jets. I'm an engineer by profession, so kind of a technical person, and there's a lot of technicality within the jets. So yeah, I enjoy it.
What was that first jet you flew that hooked you up?
Okay, so the first jet was actually a friend of mine. His name is Amir, from here in Israel. I taught him how to fly helicopters back at the time. So one day he comes over and he said, hey, listen, I found an interesting plane on eBay and I want to buy it. And I'm like, okay, yeah, show it to me. And it was a Surmark F-16. Like I said, around 15 years ago, maybe even a bit more. And I was like, well, you know, it's a jet, and jets are very complicated. At least that's what I thought at the time. So sure, if you want to buy it, and let's see what we can do with it. So he did, and he brought it to me. And I remember what he said. He said, listen, you're my instructor in the helicopter field, right? And I trust your opinion. So if you think you should fly it, then you will fly it. But if you think someone else is better to fly it, then I'll give it to that someone else. Whatever you decide is fine with me, because I think you have better judgment than myself. So I remember actually thinking about it very hard for a couple of weeks, you know, until I made the decision. I told him, hey, if this was mine, I would fly it myself. And he said, okay, then it's yours. Go ahead and fly it. So I've done a lot of research online. Back at the time, it was on RC Universe. Facebook was either not existent or maybe somewhere in the beginning. I don't even remember. It was a very long time ago. And I started asking people. I logged into RC Universe. Probably if you look up that thread, you'll still be able to find it. Where I told people, hey, listen, I flew models, I flew helicopters, and I want to try this Saramark F-16. It was a small F-16 with a 5-kilo turbine from RAM. And people were like, yeah, okay, that plane is kind of nice to fly. It's no big deal. If you've flown fast prop planes, we think you can do it. And I said, okay, yeah, you know, sounds good. Let's try it. And it was a really funny story. We went down south here in Israel to a large full-size airfield. And actually on the first flight was pretty good. But on the first flight, I had an engine cut with that small F-16. And it's all on video, by the way. It's on my YouTube channel. You can check it out. I managed to land safely, and that's it. You know, it's history ever since. It was a really, really good experience, despite the technical difficulties. And we knew, you know, right there and then that we've probably done something correctly and we'll continue doing it. So actually, the first jet was not even mine.
I assume that since then you've flown a lot of jets and you've seen big progression on the technology too, right? Like I know, I just started flying jets recently, a month or two ago. But I know 10 years ago back in Spain, I would see some people with jets and it always looked pretty cool, but it always looked not very reliable. Not only very expensive, but also you feel like every, I don't know, 30 or 40% of the times when a jet went up into the air, often they would like either, best case, would crash land, sometimes would just straight crash. But I feel like these days things have gotten much more reliable. There's more information, there's better electronics, better turbines. So I'm sure that you've seen that progression yourself then.
Yeah, for sure. So actually back at the time, at least here in Israel, there was not really... There was almost nobody to learn from. There were only a handful of pilots flying jets, and I hope they forgive me, but they were not amazing at it back at the time, 15 years ago. And it kind of created a stigma where this is, you know, it's very, very expensive and it's very, very difficult. And look, there are only a handful of top pilots and they're not doing a very good job at it. And they're always, like you said, crash landing or having trouble starting up their engines or whatever. But it is totally true that there has been a huge technology leap in the past years. I would say that jets have become, to date, mainstream, you know, in RC. Basically, anybody that can fly an RC model could transit into jets today, which was definitely not the case in the past. So the technology has improved significantly in every single field you look at. If you go back in time and you look at some of the more common problems, you know, like engine reliability, the engines today are almost flawless. There's like, you know, the reliability is very, very high. You get a very, very low percentage of issues, if any. And if you're doing a good job at assembling them and putting them in the model with a good fuel system, they will probably mostly run very, very well for a very long time. And other stuff like landing gears, pneumatic landing gears with air pressure that always had air leaks and you had to have a fail-safe mechanism to extract the gears in a case of a leak. And I cannot really tell you how many belly landings I've seen with my own eyes. Really a huge amount of them back in the time. But today, almost everybody's using electric landing gears, which are so much easier to assemble, so much more reliable to operate. So you really very rarely see a model that lands with the gear retracted. And if you do, it would usually be still be some sort of air landing gear system. So really, the technology is right up there. If you go to servos today are lighter, more powerful, a lot more accurate, significantly better in every single aspect you check. If you go to radio systems, you know, back at the time we used to fly 72 megahertz with a, you know, long whip antennas. And today you have, of course, the 2.4 spread spectrum. And with our systems, you have the 900 spread spectrum as well. You have the tandem line that can run both at the same time. So radio problems are really not an issue anymore. So yeah, technology is heaps better, you know, and it really helps pilots do all this stuff very reliably and very easily. Back at the day, you really had to be very finicky about where you place your receiver, which type of antenna you use. We had like these metal rods that we use for antennas. You had to screw them onto a small screw on the plane. I've seen one of them fly off at a model during flight at some point. So yeah, today it really is so much better that I really think that jets have become a mainstream. Like I said, and even if all that is considered, they are still much, much cheaper than back in the time. Because I remember the stigma was when I started that the jet is like $10,000, you know, to start with. And I think today you would find you can start with jets that cost $2,000, maybe $3,000 maximum at the beginning and still get very good results for most pilots. So yeah, technology has definitely changed the field. By the way, not only in jets, but in RC in general.
Yeah, I think the other thing that has attracted me to jets too have been the airframes themselves. I know back in the day, I don't know, at least in Spain, in Europe, where I saw 90% of the planes were scale jets that look really, really cool. But as you know, they tend to be more complex. Landing gear systems are trickier. Many of them don't have the best flying characteristics. But I feel like lately there's been a lot more sports jets coming out, lighter construction, easier construction, better flying characteristics. And that's been, at least for me personally, it's one of the things that has definitely attracted me to towards jets. Like you not only have to do like a couple of circles and sound roll, you can actually do like pretty good aerobatics. And on top of it now with like thrust vector, you can even do some 3D.
Yeah. And you can even get them in PNP format, you know, for people that don't have a lot of time to invest in this. This is also something that back in the day you had to work for a very, very long time to actually assemble and build a model, you know. And today, I've got some PNP models that I got one day and could fly the next day. And if you go to the most extreme, in one of the jet power events in Germany that I flew for a very good friend of mine, Jean-Marc from JMB Jets, I arrived at the airfield, and it was Thursday, and the event is like Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So Jean-Marc comes to the tent, and I asked him, hey, where's that Viper jet I'm supposed to fly? And he points at the box standing on the side, closed with the seal and everything. He's like, yeah, there it is. And I'm like, yeah, okay. So that box is going to fly here today for practice, and he's looking at the box, and he goes like, yeah, sure, why not? And I'm like, well, yeah, that's a new record. And really, 3 hours later, that plane from the sealed box was flying at the airfield for practice flights. So it's incredible. Again, so also from, yeah, so you could not do this before, you know. So the planes have a very high level of finish and build. So yeah, it's definitely easier.
You've been flying jets for a very long time. You've flown a lot of your own jets and other people's jets. You've helped set up a lot of different airplanes and systems. I'm sure you've seen a lot of really good stuff and a lot of not so good. So I'm curious to hear, in your opinion, what are typical mistakes people make when building, when setting up their jets? What type of advice you have for people either getting started into jets or even people with experience but they still struggle here and there? What are the most common issues you see and how to avoid them?
So let's separate the building and the flying, okay? I'll answer both. And really, there is some common ground between both answers. What I highly recommend to anybody, especially someone that's starting in this field, is use help from other people. I cannot emphasize this enough. Almost every single time when I see somebody that bought a new shiny jet and wants to fly it on his own or set it up on his own for the first time, it doesn't end well. So really, use help from other people. You have to be a very good modeler to get a jet for the first time. You know, do it all on your own and be successful. And I'm being perfectly honest here. I do a lot of setups for people and I enjoy it. I like helping others, people getting into the field or, you know, progressing within the field, and that's all good. So let's talk about building, okay? Or maybe assembling is more appropriate for most jets today. usually what I find is I came from helicopters, okay, into jets. And when you're setting up a helicopter, an RC helicopter, all of the principles of symmetry and servos, linkages, and mechanics are very well embedded in you, you know, so you cannot... You can't get a helicopter to fly or at least fly decent if it's not set up very well. All the servos are mechanically centered well. All the push rods, all the levers are, you know, either parallel or vertical, whatever is needed. So I use the same principle when I set up an airplane. And I've seen a lot of people that if, for example, you have a servo with a horn going like this in the center, somebody would put the horn like this and install the servo, and it would tell me, yeah, okay, use subtrim, you know, like 200% of subtrim. So the entire working point of the servo is shifted, and that may create some issues down the road. Or if somebody puts a very long servo horn and he goes like, yeah, okay, you know, limit the travel, whatever is needed, that's no problem. But they don't really understand that if you use a very long servo horn, you lose the torque, you lose the precision, you lose the resolution, you lose almost every single aspect within the servo. So I always tell people, you know, use mechanical servo arms that allow you to get the travel that you exactly need at 100%. And some people just have a hard time grasping the concept of mechanical setup and how important it is, really. And I always say, anything flies, but you have to differentiate what flies and what flies well. And it really is a huge, huge difference whether a model is set up or it's set up well. Because I've taken some models in my hands that were really unflyable. I'm not kidding. They were very, very difficult to fly. Somebody would come to me at the field and say, "Hey, try my jet. It's flying already. You know, it's all good, sort of." And I would take the radio, do one lap, and I would put the radio back and say, "Hey, man, listen. I don't know how you fly this thing. Let me play with it a little bit, and I'll give it back to you, and let me know if you like it." And I always, you know, do 5 minutes of setup on the ground, and their reactions are always incredible. Like, wow, I can't believe this plane flies so well now after 5 minutes that you've played with it. So I think that people don't really emphasize enough or don't really invest enough in setup. And setup, well, while being individual, there are mostly, you know, common turns behind it. So I can tell you that every time I've set up a model for somebody, maybe took some minor tweaks to kind of get the feel of, you know, whoever or whatever they want and how they want the model to feel. But they were always very happy with the result. I have some of my flying students always tell others, you know, when this guy set up my plane, it landed on its own. But when someone else set up my plane, I'm having a very hard time making it land in one piece. So it's a huge, huge difference. So my advice is find someone who's very, very good at setup and use his knowledge. You know, it's great. And as far as flying, I said there's some common ground. Find a good instructor, someone that you see is doing a very, very good job at flying and instructing, and follow him. You know, you can always tell when you see these very experienced jet pilots that never land in one piece. Are you familiar with those? Always break the landing gears on landing, always break something on landing, even if they're flying jets for 30 years. So you can always tell when somebody hasn't had the base training, basically, or the basic training, and still grew up within the field, and that's fine. You know, it's a hobby. If somebody likes to break a landing gear every flight, it's okay. But I think that if you invest in the beginning and you get the basics very, very well within you, then down the road, it would definitely be worth it.
Yeah, agreed. Agreed with both points. And the setup, super important. I just yesterday was in the field helping Maiden Diablo, Carve Diablo, beautiful. But yeah, like the issue you mentioned before, arms way too long for the amount of throw. Another person with a P-51, also giant arms. I think that's a surprisingly common occurrence. I think me coming from like 3D planes where You have to get really high throws, but still care a lot about the servos, because the servos will die very quickly if you are not careful with that. That's been a very quickly learned lesson in the past. So I'm very mindful about that. But I think a lot of people coming from a small, simple planes where they just make things move to the right direction, and as long as it moves to the correct direction, then it's all good. When they transition to bigger, more complex planes, they don't realize that those type of things are pretty important. It's not just enough to put in some arm that will move the aileron to the right direction and you're done.
And another thing, by the way, that's also very important regarding setup is what you do with your radio system. And in the term of capabilities and functions, and I'll give you an example. A lot of people don't use flight modes, for at least here. Maybe it's different in the States, I don't know. But at least around here, most people that I find at the field don't use flight modes with separate trims, let's say for flaps. And then you have three flap positions. And some people tell me, you know, it's no big deal. I don't need a mix. I lower the flap and I fly the elevator. Oh, that's very, very bad as far as I'm concerned. It makes the model very difficult to fly. I had one guy give me a model to land. It was Rebel Pro. And that thing is like it's a big glider, really, with a turbine. So easy to fly. But as soon as I lowered the flaps, it almost did a loop in full flaps. It ballooned like crazy. It went like vertical in a second. And I was like, hey, dude, you fly this model like this? And he was, yeah, you know, it's no problem. I just push down and land. Like, okay, again, give me a minute with your plane, please, and tell me if you like the result. So flight modes and trims, just as a general example. Lots of people don't use them. Some people use program mixing and then, you know, adjust it to a base point, fly, see what happens, land, adjust again, take off, land, adjust again. It's just tedious, you know. It makes everything so much more difficult. And when you're flying a model that's very fast sometimes, and high wing loaded and so on, you want it to be as easy as possible. I always tell people, it's a hobby. You need to have fun. You're not supposed to fight the thing, you know. If you're fighting the thing, then you're doing something wrong. Flight modes, trims, whatever you can use in your system that helps you fly calmly, safely, and accurately is a blessing. And some people just don't give it the amount of attention, I think.
Yeah, even taking note from full-scale planes and pilots, like a big thing there is trying to always reduce your workload, right? Like when you're doing flight training full-scale, you're often trimming the plane to basically have the plane fly for you. If you're going stable, if you're coming on a descent, you trim it so that you can be almost hands-off. So you're not fighting the plane. You can focus on all the other things you have to be doing. So I think here, all of that definitely applies.
Yeah, you have to focus on 15 things, you know, when landing a jet anyway. So if you reduce two out of the 15, you've done a very good job. So it really is a matter of workload. If you're thinking about your pitch, you're putting less thought within your center line, for example. That's just obvious. You know, you're a person, you have a limited amount of processing power. Like every processor. So reducing the workload is very, very important. And that's a direct connection to setup. You know, that's always the same.
The other area I've often seen people have issues with jets is fuel systems. Like a very common reason for seeing people crashing nowadays are flameouts. And I feel like 8 or 9 out of 10 of those times, it's not necessarily something wrong with the turbine itself. It's just that we don't get fuel into the turbine or fuel into the pump. Have you seen any kind of common problems there, common mistakes people make that lead to those type of situations?
Yeah, definitely. Probably the most common issue with turbines is turbines need a very reliable and very straightforward fuel feed. And some turbines are more prone to cutting even if a very small air bubble is induced within the fuel. So definitely the number one reason for engine cuts and turbines are air bubbles. As far as common problems, yes, I've seen several. Some people may disagree with me, but I personally don't use any fast Festo connection fittings on the suction line. Some people will tell you that they are rated for a certain amount of suction, which is true if you look at the specs. But I just find it's a bit dangerous, let's say, because, you know, you have to push the things very hard together. And sometimes if you stop maybe, you know, a 1 millimeter before the end, you may induce some air bubbles at the time. I've seen a lot of issue with those when used on the suction line. So I try to not to use them on this side. Use them on the other line from the pump to the engine itself is a bit more reliable. The second thing I see is, of course, you know, like always, fuel lines, clunks. Some people like to use felt clunks on their fuel tanks. Which I strongly disagree. I find that after some time they tend to become dry, break up, and kind of mess up your fuel feed, and also may induce some air into the line. So that's not very good. Other than that, small diameter vent fittings, which again is something not a lot of people are taking into consideration. I like to use 6 millimeter fittings on all jets. If you see all the jets there in the back, they all have like a similar to a Festo 6 millimeter fitting on the bottom, which is very big bore. So, you know, you get a lot of air going through the vent fitting. Some people use the fittings that come from gasoline models and so on. They have 3 millimeter or 4 millimeter holes in them, very, very small holes. And then the pump would work very hard just to suck the fuel from the fuel tank into the turbine. So that may also lead to some problems.
Are you talking 6 millimeter outer diameter?
Inner diameter.
Inner diameter. Okay, that's a pretty big one.
Yeah, it's a big one. So you actually, there are those fittings that look like a Festo double-sided fitting, and the 6 millimeter tube will just push inside. So it's a 6 millimeter inner diameter, and it doesn't cost anything as far as, you know, it may be slightly less pretty than using a nice small whatever fitting, you know, but it's no big deal. You want to have your fuel system be able to breathe. These turbines can consume a lot of fuel, can have a rather high fuel rate. So you want to have very easy airflow coming in from the other end. And this is something that I've seen that some people had issues with.
So you mentioned before about you personally don't like those clunks that have kind of like a built-in, yeah. What do you like using inside the tank? Do you use Viton?
I use either Viton or Tigon. It depends on the tank structure. I've had pretty good success with both, honestly. But from the fuel tank and through my whole fuel system, I like to use the PO or polyurethane tubing, which is more stiff tubing, and it's much less prone to kind of sucking in under you know, suction loads. I use Tigon, you know, in this fuel system itself. I try to use Tigon only for the fueling line itself. So that's from your fuel dot or fueling point to the UAT. So the entire fuel system from the tanks to the engine is polyurethane.
And that's the transparent line, basically, right? That's the, yeah,
Festo transparent line or similar. Yeah, Festo style. Yeah. And that's been working very well for me. But I cannot emphasize enough, again, we're talking about setup, how important it is to check your fuel tanks before you put them in the plane. Verify that everything is very well sealed. If not, seal it. Make sure that your clunk line is very free and can reach any point in a tank. That may save you a plane, really. It's that simple. And use high-quality components in the fuel system. Personally, for me, I use a lot of tanks from Carlos in Spain, CM Jets, the Kevlar tanks, almost in all my planes, and with very good results. And as far as the auxiliary or the UAT, I like to use the ones from FCT, from Salim in the UK, from the jeweler. And again, very good results. And I'm the kind of person that when I find that something works very well, I kind of like to stick with it. You know, I don't try to change what works very well all the time. So you would find in my build threads and so on, a tank from Carlos and an FCT UAT pretty much in, I think, maybe all my planes or at least almost all my planes. And it's a very good combo. But again, test, test, and test. You may find that you buy, you know, the best equipment on the planet, but still, if you put it under pressure in a bucket of water, you may find that it's leaking a very small amount of air. You know, test everything externally. You know, these fiberglass tanks that come with the models many times have very small pinholes, and those could induce some air bubbles into the fuel tank and so on. So really, test what you can. Use safety wire where is needed, on fuel fittings. That's also important. And do it correctly. The correct way to do a safety wire, you know, if you have a fitting, is run two loops. Some people like to run just one loop and twist the wire, and then they get a point where the tubing kind of kinks on the fitting, and instead of helping you, it may kill your plane. So run two loops, you know, do your research, look at how things are done properly, and really do everything properly on the fuel system. The fuel system is the pumping heart of your engine and your aircraft when it's in the air, really.
Because we're diving pretty deep into some of these details, I'm kind of curious, inside your fuel tank, you said you can use either Tygon or Viton, and one of the things you mentioned is making sure that the line can reach any point in the fuel, so that if you're in some extreme stress position, you're going to still get fuel. Do you like setting up some kind of like brass tubing inside, so that you have that kind of stiff portion, so that cannot like get stuck in inverted, in like a reverse position?
Yeah, so it's a good question. The answer would be it really depends on the structure of the tank or the shape of the tank. On tanks that are longer, where you would expect the fuel line always to be in the back, the answer is yes. I like to use a piece of hard tubing in the center, either just a piece of brass tubing with the two brass olives that you can solder yourself for, you know, 20 cents, and you can do it on your own. Or, again, one from FCT, they have a very nice, like, aluminum tubing with two lock nuts on the end that kind of lock the tube into the fitting. But, yeah, I use them, but on some tanks, for example, in a Top RC Odyssey, the tank was almost triangle shaped. So you really wanted that extra flexibility in the clunk, that it, you know, if it goes like this and a clunk comes into the triangle, you don't want to kind of lock the clunk in a very small portion of the tank. So you want to have the more flexible fuel tubing to be able to rotate a little bit around the back. So in this type, I wouldn't use a connecting tube in the middle. So the answer would be really depending on the type of the tank. If it's a very standard size tank, then yeah, yes, for sure.
So maybe switching gears a little bit. I know you've been a big advocate for free sky in general, and specifically around jets. I'm kind of curious, what system were you using prior to free sky, and what made you think about switching to free sky?
So it's a funny story. Like I said, I've been flying for 30 years. I started with Futaba as a child. That was back in the day, AM 72 megahertz, and have been using Futaba ever since for 25 years. Around several years ago, my buddy came to me with a Taranis from FR Sky. Back in the day, it looked like a JR knockoff or something. They used very similar plastic casing, very, very simple. And he started flying his newly acquired jet with it. And like everybody, at first I looked at it and said, hey, you know, it looks kind of funny. I don't know. It doesn't look extremely professional back in the day. But his results were very good. And at some point, one of the guys online posted a project that you can build your own telemetry unit for an FR Sky radio and for a specific ECU type. I don't even remember which type it was back in the day. And I built one for him since he had the same turbine. And we ran the telemetry and it knocked my socks off. You know, it's a very simple $200 radio with a black and white screen, but you get RPM, temperature, EGT, you know, fuel, pump, voltage. And I was like, hey, man, look, my very, very expensive Futaba doesn't even have this something called Lua script option, you know, to display the data the way you like it to be displayed. And I'm like, and I started thinking, like, you know, I can do this for Futaba, but it's with my back in the day 18 MZ, $3,000 I paid for that thing, I have to say, from my own pocket money. It's not like I wasn't sponsored or anything. And this guy comes in with a $200 plastic radio, and he's getting very good performance in flight, and he's got much better telemetry than I do. And I started thinking, I was like, look, I must be missing something, right? It doesn't make sense. $200 versus $3,000, and you know, my radio is all nice and shiny, it's beautiful, it's all good, but it lacks the functionality. So around that time, FRSky started coming out with this, with the Horus line. And this is one of my old ones just laying here. And it had a color screen and a bunch of nice features and so on. And I was like, hey, you know, I'm willing to give this a try. And I think the Horus was at the time $450 or something. And I bought one. At the time, I didn't even realize how good it was. So I bought it with a regular 2.4 configuration, and you could actually install this 900 module in the back, but it didn't come with it. So it was just a regular 2.4 radio at the time. And I started playing with this interesting feature called Lua. Started reading about what it does, and you start finding out that there's a lot of customization that you're able to do at home, which is pretty unusual, because with Futaba you have, you know, zero. You get the same menus that whoever programmed the radio built for you, and that's it. You cannot do anything else with it. And the alerts were very basic and so on. I can give you an example. You know, I started building telemetry units down the road and so on. And I've built them for Futaba and for FRSky. And I was flying Futaba at the time. Built them for myself, basically. So I wanted to do an engine cut alert. Quite simply the most common and most needed alert for a turbine jet, right? If you get an engine cut and there's a lot of noise around, people flying other jets, maybe starting a jet next to you, you may not hear it and you may lose your plane. So I wanted to do an engine cut alert. So I started thinking about, in my Futaba, which parameter should I be looking at to notify me that the engine has been cut. So the basic answer would probably be the RPM, because if the RPM is coming down under the idle RPM or a lot less than the idle RPM, then, well, your engine's cut, right? So I built a sensor. I developed a sensor which was working nicely and started looking at this function, you know, look at RPM for engine cut. And I started thinking, okay, my engine idles at 50,000 RPM, okay, just as an example. So anywhere under 40 is probably an engine cut. So I defined the logic in the Futaba alert. If you're under 40,000, you know, sound a wave file that says engine cut or whatever. The funny thing is that you cannot wrap this with any other logics. So if you haven't started your engine, the engine is at zero RPM, it would always yell that it's an engine cut, and it would drive you crazy. Again, we're talking about minimizing the load, right? You're at the field, you want to start, and your radio is going, engine cut, and it really can drive you crazy. Yeah, it's terrible. So I grabbed one of these and started playing with the logic switches and found that I can fairly easy look at RPM under 40,000 and look at the status value to see if the engine has ever reached a running status. So if it's reached a running status, that means it has been successfully started and your RPM has dropped, then your engine's already been started, the RPM has dropped, well, you're at an engine cut state and it doesn't yell at you. And I even added a switch that says look at the trim. If the trim is down, then I cut the engine myself. I don't need an alert, right? So if the trim is not down, only then sound your alert. And at this point in time, where I had this Horus radio together with the Futaba 18MZ, that's where it hit me. You know, I'm like, okay, this $450 radio is way, way, way more functional than Futaba's $3,000 radio. And the flight performance was great. I was flying 2.4, only 2.4 at the time. And there were no issues. You know, I've been flying it for a while, flying both, and it was all good. And at some point, I started reading that you can stick this strange module in the back and get 900. I didn't even realize what it was at the time. But so I bought a set to play with it. And then I found that you can actually run two bands at the same time, two frequency bands, okay, one 2.4 and one 900. And you can actually wire the two receivers together using a single servo wire. And if one receiver drops, it would pick up the signal from the other and transmit that out to your servo. It was really that simple. And that's where I knew, you know, there's really no competition. And with the latest tandem line of radios, with the new operating system, with ETOS, it's just way easier. Everything is built in. The interface is so much easier. It's, I always tell people, you know, that really like the high-end stuff and think that the high-end is measured by the price. I always tell them, just wait until you try one of these and you will understand. It's so powerful. It's got so much functionality in it. It really is a lot more advanced than anything else I've tried. And I've been playing with this telemetries and Lua scripts down the road for quite a few years now. And I'm sure most people that would watch this video and have played with the FR SkyJets would probably have seen my telemetry videos and so on, would agree that it makes, again, it takes down your workload. You have something is running in the background monitoring your engine. You have a nice display if you want to look at it on the ground. Of course, not when you're flying. It's giving you live alerts, you know, if you're on low fuel, if your engine is cut, if your engine's overheated, whatever. It will just read out to you whatever is wrong. So again, it's taking down your workload when you're flying, and it's improving your flight safety. That's why I always said for my brand, for Zavionics, my slogan was making your models safer. That's my main goal, and I've done all this stuff for myself. And we'll get to that in a minute, but it really started from doing my own stuff for myself because I wanted to improve my, you know, personal experience in a hobby.
Yeah. I've been using FreeSky for like a few months, and definitely have felt some of that same feeling, like, you know, this much more affordable transmitter actually lets you do much more than you could with like a $1,500, $2,500 radio, surprisingly. And on top of it, the reliability of the link with the tandem 2.4 and 900, it's definitely very nice for any plane, in particular for like this expensive jets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree. I fly it in all my jets in the past 5 years or so. I think that between me and my team, we probably have thousands of flights, at least hundreds or many hundreds of flights with jets, with FreeSky, with zero issues. I've been in situations where in local fields here with people suffer a lot from 2.4, where other radio systems were just flying next to me. When I was flying tandem, and they had some lockout problems or fail safes and so on. And with my radio, there was never an issue at the same time, you know, just standing shoulder to shoulder. So, I cannot stress how good this stuff is. I really think that anybody who tries it would see. And the price point is just a bonus. It really is completely disconnected from the functionality, capability, and reliability. That's my opinion.
Yep. I think it's great. That's the same way I look at it. I think right now, if I had to spend $1,500 in that radio, I would, because like it's not the main cost. The main cost is like the planes and the expense you have in the air, and if you have a problem and you crash, that's what's gonna hurt, not the $500 savings on the transmitter.
That's exactly what I always tell people. When people ask me, hey, how are you flying a $20,000 jet using a $500 radio? I would say, listen, if the $3,000 radio was any better, I would be flying a $3,000. I had a $3,000 radio, okay? More than one, to be honest. And if I really thought it was the slightest bit better, I would be using it. It's that simple. But this thing is so powerful. It's leaps and bounds above anything else, really.
Are you seeing the X20S these days or the Pro?
So I've been using the X20S since it came out. I think it was, 2 years already? And I got the first X20 Pro here in Israel from the very first batch, and it's right here behind me. And I've been using it also since it arrived. I'm just too lazy to rebind all my models to the Pro. But, you know, I transferred all my models, just a copy, like a model copy-paste function on the SD card. It's that simple. It takes 5 seconds to transfer the models from one radio to the other. By the way, another feature that was terrible with Futaba back in the time. We can talk about that for hours, about resetting up models, copying numbers over from the 18MZ to this 18SZ because you could convert one to the other, but not the other to the first. But very, very strange features. So yeah, I just copied all my models to the X20 Pro, and I've been flying it for a few weeks, and it's very nice. It's been working very well. Well, that was really expected, but yeah, works very well.
So we touched on this a bit before, but let's talk a bit about Zabionix. What's Zabionix? When did you start? And what are you doing there?
So a few years ago, like I said earlier, I started looking into telemetries for my own setup. We had several cases here in Israel where people didn't hear they had engine cuts, real life cases, you know, and crashed their models because someone would start like a gas plane or something on the ground, standing in the pits waiting to take off. Somebody else would fly a jet, would get an engine cut, wouldn't hear it, you know, notice it a bit too late. It doesn't make the runway, boom, crash it, and you lose, you know, $5,000 worth of damage for basically nothing just because you didn't get an alert. So I started looking into telemetry a few years ago, and my first telemetry units, the first one was actually a project that was posted online. Like I said, I downloaded that project, played with it a little bit, managed to run it, and was very, very impressed. Started looking at doing the same for Futaba and kind of improved it along the way. And again, all for myself, not for anyone else. And back in the day, I used one turbine type, and then maybe sometime later, I had another turbine, so I had to redevelop the interface of that same telemetry unit to speak with a different turbine, different protocol, and so on. And it kind of picked up. I started posting some videos. You know, I like videos. I like to post RC videos. Hey, look, this cool telemetry unit that I've developed can plug into your ECU and give you some data on your radio. How cool. You can find when you had an engine cut or when you are low on fuel or whatever. And people started asking for it. I didn't even offer anything. So I say, hey, man, you know, this is looking good. I think I need one for my plane. So I started making them for people, and that's basically how it started. At some point, someone told me, hey, you need a brand name because you're doing some very nice things for modelers, and they need to identify it somehow, you know. So I invented Zavionix, which is my last name. Zahavi is the ZA, and Avionix, since we're talking about model Avionix. And it's kind of picked up ever since, and you can look on GitHub, for example, for my Zavionix page. You would find that I've put a huge, huge, huge amount of work, and we're talking really, you know, hundreds of hours of development of Lua scripts, and they're all for free. They're all on my Zavionix GitHub page. Anybody with an FR Sky radio can download these, install them, enjoy them, do whatever you want with them. It's all good. It kind of, it's my, I always tell people it's kind of my gift to the hobby that I love so much. You know, I really like the stuff, so I'm happy that people are using it and liking them. But I have to say, it's not my job. I do it on my free time. I have a full-time job as an engineer. So it kind of relates together, but Zavionix is just for fun. Really, the sensors that I make and the barely cover the cost to make them. I'm being very honest here. It's all handmade. It's all right here on this desk. Okay. So it's not like I have a huge factory behind me or something. It's all for friends, and it's all good and fun.
Yeah. And I must say, I recently got the chance to use your telemetry module for Sikoi turbines. So I have an RDT in my Dragon, and it's been working great. Can you maybe talk a bit about what are the different units, what are different products that you're currently producing. So you have these RDTs, which are the telemetry units for different turbines, right?
Yeah. So it started back in the day before telemetry was even available because the radios didn't support it. We used to fly in the jets like small LCD screens. Instead of hooking up the big GSU, you know, the external one, you would sometimes put a small screen in your plane and just read the data right off that screen. Let me see if I have one lying around here. I used to have one here. Yeah, I have an example of something like this size, very, very small LCD. So I've developed a bunch of these for turbines. It's like I said, it's basically a very small LCD you put inside your plane on the tray. It's very light, and you can read the turbine data right here. So what that took was a lot of development in actually reading the turbine data and just laying it over on the screen. But it was a good fundamental for transitioning into telemetry, because one side was already done. You know, there were, I don't know, I did like 8 or 10 different types of turbines with these, and they could support almost any brand of turbine. And then telemetry radio started hitting the market, and looking into telemetry, I say, hey, you know, why do I need the screen? I have the screen of my radio. It's always in my hands. There's no point in adding another component into the plane. And if I have it in my hands and not up there inside the model, I can actually set the alerts and so on, and maybe help myself a little bit with flight safety. And it kind of went from there. So we're talking about telemetry units, a turbine telemetry units for FR Sky and for Futaba. Nobody is interested in the Futaba anymore. Sorry to say that. But really, FR Sky is the thing. So all turbine types with FR Sky. And the other sensors that I made, also telemetry sensors, were, again, always when somebody was asked for them. Someone approached me at some point and said, hey, listen, if you make an air pressure sensor, and that was way before FR Sky had theirs, if you make an air pressure sensor, then we can monitor the air pressure, we can send it to the radio, and you will always know what air pressure you have in your landing gear during flight, and you can always use it with a logic switch as a fail-safe unit. It will also extract your gear if the pressure drops down under a certain amount. So I did an air pressure sensor, and then there was one guy that said, hey, I need a current sensor for 150 amps. So I developed a current sensor, because FR Sky at the time had only 100 amps, and he was using a large electric model. So my electric models use my own sensors now. So it really kind of, you know, ran down the road with what people were asking. And unfortunately, the Zavionics page on Facebook, I don't really have time to manage it. So it's kind of outdated. But I've done a whole bunch of sensors for electric planes, for turbines, for gas engines, RPM, cylinder head temperatures, fuel, also for gas. So basically anything that, you know, since I enjoyed so much, whenever somebody would come and say, hey, listen, I think I need this XYZ sensor to improve my flight safety or improve my whatever capability in flying, I would say, yeah, why not? I'll play with it. If I can, I'll make you one. And I have a whole bunch. So I always tell people, if you need something, you can ask me, because I don't have time to list everything. I've done a GPS sensor at the time, a high rate GPS. Like a higher refresh rate and a bit more accurate and very, very small, very lightweight. I had a pedo tube sensor for airspeed for people that want to have stall prevention and stuff like that. Again, some people ask for that. What else? I don't even remember from the top of my head, but really, there was one guy, his name is Noam. He'll probably be watching this video very soon. He's also just gone into FR Sky, and he wanted a very specific sensor for limit switches on his landing gear. He installs these small limit switches to indicate what his gear position is. So I'll probably be making one for him. Just think how cool this is. There are endless options. If you put this these small limit switches on your landing gear, then I can make a custom sensor fairly easily, because I have the infrastructure already, and I can make a custom sensor that would tell you exactly what is the status of each and every one of your three gears. And let's couple that and just think into this. Let's couple that with three LEDs on the Lua script, right, on the screen. And you have like three reds or three greens or yellow for transition, whatever, exactly the same as in full scale, right? And let's couple that with a voice readout. So when you retract your gears, the radio would actually tell you, hey, your gears are actually fully retracted. I can verify that your gears have been fully retracted or fully extracted. So the options are endless. And since I gladly have the infrastructure, it's fairly easy to do all this custom stuff. So yeah, it's a lot of fun.
I can imagine when people watching this, you're going to get a bunch of additional requests now of developing a bunch of cool scripts and sensors.
I just did it. If you saw, I just did the twin turbine. A bunch of people were asking for that. And unfortunately, I didn't have a lot of time to put into this. One night, I had some free time. I was like, yeah, you know, I'm going to watch TV or maybe start working on the twin turbine RDT widget. And you kind of blazed through it in a couple days, couple evenings, and the thing was done. And it's already posted. Again, it's a free download. Anybody can download it and use it. So again, it's a lot of fun. I'm happy people like them. And if somebody that's watching this video has some interesting custom requests, you know, shoot me a message on Facebook or send me an email. I'll try to help whatever I can.
Cool. Yeah, I'll make sure to put some links to your GitHub and your Facebook so people can take a look at all this cool stuff you're doing.
Awesome.
Let's talk airplanes. What are you flying these days?
Oh yeah, that's a difficult question. You can see some of them in here. Let's say bottom to top. There's the DE3D from Denieric Design, the 3D Vector Thrust Sportjet, then the ARG Next, the red one from ARG in Italy. There's the wings of the Glider IT Swift here. Boomerang Ranger, a really nice small sportjet, and then there's the Trinity right there on the top. From RC Passion in France, a large size sport jet, this beautiful, beautiful glider from Glider IT, the Swift 32 with a KingTech, the brand new K86 on the top, extremely powerful, would probably be able to fly well on a 45, but hey, I had it at home, so there's a bunch more that way. Yeah, there's the Voyager from Top RC. Yeah, DRS, probably my all-time favorite, I have to say. The RS is a work of art, really. It's beautiful, beautifully built and beautiful flying model. Very, very lightweight, very light wing loading. It really is a doll to fly. Then there's this foam T45 from AF model. Foam jet flies very, very well, and it looks very scaled. This RV8 is actually my night flyer. It's full of lights, the one from Flex Innovations. It's the big one, electric. Then there's a bunch more there that you can probably barely see. The Saab Lizard, the Ultra Flash. I have the Viper from FMS with a KingTech 45. Again, the foamy. So I fly a lot of stuff. Yeah, a lot of options, and we'll probably be, sorry, just put my camera back, and we'll probably be building some new stuff. Also, I'm actually building an L39 from Top RC at the moment, or one of my builders is building them. And there is also a very, very interesting and brand new sport jet. I don't want to say the name just yet, maybe even two coming soon. So yeah, look at my page and stay tuned. There's always good stuff. I like to do, we haven't talked about it, but I like to do build threads for pretty much anything I build. And I find that a lot of people like them. So again, it's a good thing and a hobby to have. You know, I like this interaction with the people. So I do a lot of build threads and I review a lot of equipment. So anybody that's interested in any one of the jets that I've just shown, you can go into the groups on Facebook and check out my build threads.
And is that usually, yeah, RC Universe?
Facebook, mostly. Facebook. Yeah, I used to do them on RC Universe before Facebook was big, but I found that, at least to me, it appears that most of the community has transitioned in the past years from RC Universe to Facebook. And I actually manage a lot of RC jets or RC related groups or and communities on Facebook myself. I think I manage groups with more than 100,000 RC pilots combined.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, it's nice.
What's your typical setup for a jet? Like, if you're putting together a new jet, what's your go-to gear that you use for that?
So we've talked about the AFR Sky radios, of course. We talked about that previously. As far as turbines, I'm using all KingTech turbines today. G2 all the way through G4 plus, latest, you know, small, lightweight, high power models. And I really love them. They're fairly simple to use, very, very reliable. Plug and play, one single fuel line, one single cable, you know, do the throttle learning process and you're good to go. And as far as electronics, I fly the advanced radio or boom RC, AR, whatever you want to call it, equipment from Australia, from Brandon and Rick Gell. And when I order equipment for a model today, or when I ordered the electric equipment for a model today, I just log into the AR website and, you know, make a list of everything I put in the model. That includes the box itself, the power distribution and gyro. It's the Smooth Flight is the one I'm using. Then the AR servos, which are very, very high quality, high end servos. The AR cables, which are again high quality, high end extension cables that you can get per size exactly to match your plane. Connectors and everything. So I just build a nice shopping cart that has pretty much all of the electronics components that I use in the plane. And it all comes in one around, you know, shoebox size box, and you get whatever you want. So I've found that the boxes from AR, the Smooth Flights, are a huge leap from something, or from, let's say, the past equipment that I've used. I've used other very high-end products that were, again, more expensive in the past. Some made in Europe and so on. And the boxes from AR are better in almost any extent that you check. They are smaller, they are lighter, they are much more functional, much more capable. Higher amp loading if you want to do, you know, very hard 3D stuff. They have built-in mixes that make your setup very, very simple. And they have one very interesting feature that nobody has. And as far as gyros go, yeah, of course, they have a three-axis gyro that's in built into the init, but they have one very interesting feature that's it's called an AGC, an auto gain control. So you've probably seen when a model is flying with high gains and it got into an oscillation, you know, sometimes it can get very violent very quickly. And it can get so violent that it may actually cause some structural damage on the airframe. I've seen that happen before. So what the Smooth Flight does, it has an algorithm running in the background all the time. And as soon as it senses something like this, like a single wag or a single fast oscillation, it drops down the gain immediately. So even if you have high gain, you would get like this, tuck, and boom, and the plane would just continue, you know, to fly straight and smooth. You get one oscillation maximum. That's an extremely powerful feature. I can tell you, in one of the international events that I've attended lately, there was a guy flying a Saab Lizard like mine with a gyro that didn't have this feature, and that thing is a little rocket. It flies like 400 kilometers an hour. That's like 250 miles an hour or so. And he was blasting full speed on a runway with the elevons. He started doing a roll oscillation and it was so powerful that everybody thought it was like a bomb going off. It was crazy. So, by the way, very, very strong model. It didn't break, but it was scary. And I'm sure that other models may have been broken. So, very, very good feature that's built into the system. The system is incredibly easy to use. It's got a color touchscreen. Everything you can do just, you know, by hitting it with your finger. Very, very intuitive. And usually these days I can set up a complete jet ready to fly, like from scratch, from nothing, basically just mechanical setup on the bench to completely ready to fly in around 30 minutes, which is very, very useful. You don't have to invest a lot of, you know, many hours and evenings in setting up a single airframe. I can probably do two or three in one evening.
Yeah, that auto gain reduction, something really interesting. I'm actually pretty surprised that there's something not more common in other gyros, because it's, I mean, you have the perfect sensor right there to figure that out for you, right? Like the jar itself is the best tool to figure out if you are overdoing it in the game with those oscillations. That usually when the human is able to see it, it's already way too much or way too late. Like it's very likely that if you don't get to that like extreme example, like the one you're mentioning, you still might have a bit of excessive gain, and you might not even be able to notice it yourself, just because it's hard to see from where you are. But for Jaro, that's something very, very simple to notice.
I think that the brains behind it is the detection algorithm, because you wanted to only detect when you get a real oscillation and not regular flight dynamics that can sometimes lead to something that may look like an oscillation, if you think about it, you know, with wind gusts and with control surface movements and so on. So I think that the algorithm is the big thing behind it. But of course, the raw data is right there, yeah.
Let's chat about Team Jet Israel. I've seen that a bunch of times. What is Team Jet Israel?
Yeah, so again, it's something that that's developed along the way. During the years, I started getting invitations to come and fly in international events. That's how it started, basically. Had some events in Germany, like Jet Power and Pro Wing and so on. I was in the States one time with Top Gun, with Frank Tiano, which I dearly miss. He invited me to go there, and it was an amazing experience to compete in Top Gun. So I kind of found myself, you know, traveling the world with between RC events. And having a few close friends here in Israel that support me. And these are pilots, builders. Some of them are helpers sometimes when I fly. And even a very, very extremely talented photographer that we have on our team. His name is Avgar, the Sky Architect. So, and I kind of felt that I need to put a frame around it. It's kind of hard to explain. But I found myself in a situation where I represent the hobby and represent the companies that I fly for, and I represent Israel, you know, as a pilot going to events worldwide. And I kind of wanted to put a frame around it, and I thought, hey, you know, what's a good way to do this? And then the idea to establish Team Jet Israel came up. So Team Jet Israel is essentially just a bunch of friends. Okay, it's a group of friends. It's that simple. But this very unique, very talented group of friends can do a lot in the hobby. And like I said, we build, we fly, we have probably the best aviation photographer in the world, at least the best that I'm aware of. And trust me, I've searched for competition. So, we can do a lot together and, we started Team Jet Israel. We started doing all this stuff together. And again, it kind of picked up along the way. I think Team Jet Israel today is a brand, I have to say. We don't sell anything. We don't offer any merchandise. If somebody wants some of our merch, we would send it for free. Okay? It's that simple. We all do this for fun. It's all our hobby. Nobody's working in this industry within Team Jet Israel, but it's a small group of RC enthusiasts that like to do this stuff, like to travel together, like to reach high peaks in the RC community, and really nothing more. It's that simple. We are a bunch of friends. We like to do this stuff together. We fly together. If you go into our page on Facebook, it's Team Jet Israel, and you read the introduction, I think it says something like, we build together, we set up together, and we fly together. That's it. That's Team Jet Israel right there.
Cool. Any major plans for next year? Any events you're planning to go to?
So I have a lot of plans, but I also have two small children. So, and
I know how that goes. Same here.
So yeah, I love my family very much. So I definitely have some plans. I wanted to go to a couple of events in Germany with those being Jet Power, the Renew Jet. But by the way, I don't think you've been, so think about that. It's a very, very good event, even on a worldwide scale. Jet Power and Pro Wing are both extremely good events in Europe. And some people were talking about John Knoll. Some of my sponsors were talking about John Knoll about going. So that is maybe an option on the table. But since it's a bit more far away, it makes stuff, you know, makes the logistics a bit more difficult because it's a long travel. Same for an event in Australia. Had an invitation to attend an event in Australia in March. So we'll see if we can make that happen. So yeah, there's always a lot of invitations going. Unfortunately, I don't have enough free time to attend all the events that I want, because I really want to go to all of them. You know, to be perfectly honest, I had an event in Dubai like a couple years ago. I was the first guy from Israel, you know, with a peace agreement to go to Dubai and fly in Dubai. That was incredible, just an incredible, incredible experience. So I really like going to international events, and I cannot tell you the amount of affection and love that I feel from the people is unimaginable. I always tell people that when I go to these places, I feel like a supermodel. I don't know. It's crazy, really. It's crazy. I cannot describe it in words, but I found that again, Zavionics and TeamJet Israel and everything is kind of forming up together, and I'm getting a lot of very, very good vibes from a lot of people when I go to this stuff. So I really like to go everywhere, but I cannot obligate at this point. So I'll try the events in Germany if I can make John Hall. John Hall is on my bucket list, that's for sure. If I don't make this year, it will be in the future. It's no question. You know, maybe when the kids grow up just a little bit more. I don't know. We'll see. It really depends on the situation at the time. But yeah, I've been to a bunch of them, and I really want to go to more.
Yeah, sounds a bit like me. I have a one-year-old, two-year-old, a lot of events in the bucket list, a lot of invitations. It's just hard to find the time to make it happen.
Mine are 4 and 2. It's slightly easier, but almost the same. Yeah.
I'm hoping to make it to Jonal 2024. I haven't been there before, and I'd love to go.
How far is it for you?
It's far. I mean, it's opposite end of the country, but at least I'm in the US.
Yeah, sure.
I think this year with some of the sponsors, it's going to be much more doable. I think in the past, these kind of things felt unrealistic just because it's not just about taking yourself there. It's that you know, RC planes are big. They're not easy to transport. This year with sponsors, I think it's going to be much more doable because I can just fly myself there and fly other planes, right?
I traveled with a jet a couple of times to Germany. It was a horrible experience. So I found that, and they broke it both times. I mean, the airline guys, yeah, it was always broken. So I always had to fix in the field. So it's very difficult. You kind of, when you come back from a trip like this, you're wasted. You know, you're done. You're very, very tired from doing a lot of work. So I've found that, at least for me, if I can use some of my sponsor capabilities to fly a plane that is local at the event, is always easier. I would usually just come there a day or two before, set up my own stuff, you know, like whatever setup I want to do on the plane, do a test flight or a series of test flights, and then be able to fly the event. So that makes stuff easier. But of course, for me, if I want to go to John Hall, it's a 12-hour flight, I believe, somewhere around that area. With jet lag and everything, again, it becomes a bit more difficult. So, and John Hall, I believe, is a week. So we're probably talking about at least a week and a half to go get away from work and family and everything. So yeah, it's something that needs to be considered carefully. I definitely want to go, but it's like you said, I'm no longer a single guy. You know, pack a bag and I'm going. yeah, for sure.
Well, if you end up making it to Jonal, let me know. Love to meet over there.
Yeah, definitely.
Cool. Well, I think this is probably pretty good. I think we are over an hour. I think there's a lot of good info there for people interested in RC and jets. And yeah, encourage people to go check out your Facebook, your Zavionics page, and there's a lot of cool stuff there.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome. Like I said, to comment on what you just said, if anybody thinks they need my help or whatever, I'm always open. You know, shoot me over a private message. If I can help you, I will gladly do it.
Awesome. Well, thanks again, Lior.
Thank you very much. See ya.